Welcome back, everyone, to the Tribal Theocrat Live Show. I'm Christian Gray. It's not December. It's February. Almost said December. It's February 23rd, 2013. And we're doing a current events show tonight. My guest and co-host is Matt Parrott. Hey, Matt.
Hey, how are you doing, Christian Gray?
It's good.
A pleasure to be here, as always. Can you hear me?
I can hear you loud and clear. Good to have you back.
Always a pleasure.
Yeah, last time we had you on, and we talked about Freemasonry. Good show. People can search the podcast archives for that one. Yep. But today we thought we'd talk about some current events, and as always, the Mexican immigration problem is always in the news, and we'll talk about that. We'll talk about solutions to that problem, what we need in terms of a leadership to move forward. Other news items, as I scan down our show notes, Matt, are, oh, how about this one? Our nice government has decided to make a swarm of tiny drones to spy on us. That's really nice and comforting, isn't it?
Well, I'm sure they're there to keep us safe and to preempt any radicals or extremists to preemptively strike before they threaten our precious government.
Yep, I agree. We should just feel safe that they're trying to help us.
Well, I mean, if you're not doing anything wrong or thinking anything wrong, I don't see what you have to worry about.
That's right. Didn't someone say that recently? If you're not doing anything wrong, why not let the government spy on you? What's there to hide?
Yeah.
I mean, the Fourth Amendment is only for people who are doing something wrong, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. Other news items are Indiana school in the South Indiana had to apologize for racist gorilla costumes. That's an interesting one.
I never got that because I know a lot of white friends. I say this lovingly, who also kind of in a cartoonish way also look like monkeys. To just look like a monkey, and then all the black people get upset. That seems like they're projecting. Nobody there said, "Hey, black people are monkeys."
I agree. I've always thought the same thing. It's the person who speaks up first is the person who is really carrying forth this so-called comparison. What else we have? This is a big one. Hundreds of thousands of Christians in Puerto Rico march against gay rights. When is the last time you've seen anything like that here in America? When do Christians march in those numbers against anything? Maybe pro-life things? I don't know. Certainly not anti-sodomy.
Well, the promise keepers show up in large numbers.
Yes, they do. And I understand you've pulled a
If I may quote this most recent promise keeper rally. Where are the men of color? Why are there not more of them here? We need to recognize that there is a spirit of white racial superiority. It's defined as insensitivity to the pain of people of color. And he continues in this vein.
Amen.
By contrast, most of us commuting in the stadium seats are white. It's time for us to get down on our knees and wash the feet of our minority brothers.
Wow.
And then he scolds them that next time, I want you to make a bona fide effort to bring someone of a different color to Washington, D.C. So if we have any non-white listeners out there, and all of a sudden you have that Christian in the office who's been ignoring you, and all of a sudden he wants to be your friend, he's probably just bringing you along as his token black buddy to his next Promise Keeper rally. He's not really your friend.
Well, if race is just skin color, maybe we could just bring our friend who has a good suntan.
And maybe like John Boehner?
I don't know what's going on there. At the end of the show, we'll talk about two articulate kinist women who spoke out in a video on Facebook against multiculturalism in very profound ways. We'll play some audio clips from that and interact with it. Good stuff, wasn't it, Matt?
Oh, yeah, I enjoyed that tremendously, and I expect to hear more of that.
Yes. Well, I guess we'll talk about the immigration problem. What we typically hear, besides that Skype sound effect I just heard from your machine, Matt.
Nope.
Just teasing. is the financial burden. First of all, I guess the estimates now are as many as 12 million illegals. Is that right? Is that
they of course, by its very nature, have no way of knowing how many.
But usually, if the mainstream media is touting that number, then it's probably more like 20 million.
Right.
But anyhow, the conservative estimates are $113 billion annually is what it costs taxpayers to fund illegals. And I've seen estimates as high as $346 billion back in 2008. So again, like you said, it's hard to really measure these things. We know that it's very, very expensive. It's a burden. And there's no question about that.
Well, even if they brought, you know, sacks of money, even if they were swimming across the river, I don't know how you'd swim across the river with a bag of gold, but if they figured out how, I would still want them to go away. You know, I understand there's this huge economic cost, but I see even resorting to that as a form of cowardice, because it's saying, you know, I don't object to being invaded. It's just, you know, this is just costing a lot of money.
Yeah.
You know, it's as if somebody broke into our home. And it's like, you know, I don't really mind this burglar being in my home. I just mind, you know, him taking my stuff.
Exactly. And that's where we really want to go with this, is that most conservatives will just talk about, oh, it's such a burden. We need to make sure these people are legal so that we don't have to pay for them. But as we know, Matt, there's a question whether we should even be dealing with the legal immigrants. And
and that's what happens when you make these economic arguments, is then the Republican traitors turn around and they're like, oh, well, we'll just charge them a fine. And that way they won't be freeloaders. That way they'll pay into the system, make them pay their taxes, and then they can usurp your birthright.
That is it. And that's why on the Tribal Theocrat homepage, when I had this post up on the banner, there was an image there that had a zoomed-in picture of the preamble to the Constitution with only the words for our posterity in focus. And that's the point that most people don't realize even about the Constitution, is this nation, back then there really were no multicultural nations, and certainly America wasn't. It was founded by our white ancestors, and it was founded for their posterity. Have you ever had the pleasure of bringing that up at a dinner party, Matt?
Yeah, I have. It makes for some awkward dinner parties.
I bet. Next Saturday, by the way, we're going to have, Lord willing, David Opperman on to talk about ethno-nationalism specifically. But it's really the idea the nations are ethnocentric, and we see that even in America's founding. And I don't know what you know, Matt, about the earlier immigration laws, but I think there was one, was it 1791, where it talked about the qualifications to come here, where that you had to be, I think it was a wealthy white man of good character, is that right?
Yeah, and you know, it was tough here, and a lot of them went back home. Tens of millions of European immigrants came here, couldn't make it or didn't like it, and went home. It wasn't this sort of just kind of flail and fail around here that you have now.
Now, what, for people who are just new to Tribal Theocrat and they're hearing this for the first time, what's the big deal with having people from different races come over here? Is it just that we're have an irrational hatred of someone based on their language or something? Maybe you could talk about some key points why multiculturalism doesn't work out. It's not practical.
Well, it's not practical on every level. You can frame it in explicitly theological terms, as you've done masterfully over and over again. You can frame it in crude scientific terms, very truthfully too. As far as people who are alien to us, we innately have less empathy for them. They have less empathy for us. You know, it's easier to steal from, or overtax, or neglect something you don't care about. And there's no way outside of the hippy-dippy fantasy of universal human love to make people care about somebody they have nothing in common with. So, it all falls apart. It's like the family metaphor is the easiest way I've found to explain the Kennist worldview. And I've not once in my really about a decade, my entire adult life of arguing for our right to exist, had anybody coherently and effectively explained to me why the extended family model is invalid. They always just resort to name-calling or kick me off the network or whatever, but they never answer, you know, because you have children, right? And I don't hate the neighborhood kids, but, you know, they're not allowed to just walk into my house and eat all my groceries.
That's right.
I'll invite them over for dinner. You know, I'll do nice things for them. You know, really like them. I'll play some baseball with them, whatever. But at the end of the day, you know, there's a certain point in the night where they have to go home because it's not their home.
That's it. Yeah, and back to, it doesn't mean that you don't like them or that you can't have any sort of fellowship with them. It just means that you have the right to...
It doesn't imply supremacism. Okay. You know, the ugliest, stupidest kids in the world, but by God, they're still my kids, you know? A person likes to think, yeah, my kids are incredibly intelligent and good-looking, but that's entirely beside the point.
Right.
It's not about that at all.
Yeah, later in the show, we're going to play the audio clips from Kristen and Nicole, and they make...
Yeah, it's such a simple case, though. We can't help but keep repeating ourselves.
It's a really simple case, and we'll just have them lay it out for us because I can't do a better job. In fact, I've been doing some Kinism FAQ audio podcasts over the last two or three weeks. I guess I have two or three up already, but the next one was going to be is Kinism supremacist, and I should probably just play Kristen's audio because it does as good a job as I can do. Of course, the answer is no. It's just a preferential love shown for our own, and that's what it comes down to. But what are the solutions in your view, Matt? Some people say build a fence. The fence would cost, last I heard, is as much as what it would cost for funding the Iraq war for 1 month. But isn't there a fence already there that's old and dilapidated?
Yeah, and you don't even need a fence. The bottom line, we don't have a Mexican immigration problem. We don't have an illegal immigration problem. We don't even have an immigration problem. What we have... It is a white Christian, finger quote, Christian Zionist traitor problem. We have a John McCain problem and a Lindsey Graham problem. And if this country's mindset and attitude were changed, they wouldn't want to come here. You know, they talk about this jobs magnet, the amnesty and the culture where people think it's okay for somebody to just come and usurp their hometown. You have places like Postville where these foreigners are just poured in by the tens of thousands on these traditional small towns. And the people in the small towns are just like, oh, well, I guess we have no moral standing to defend our right to exist and must just walk away. You know, if that were changed, there wouldn't be the problem.
I agree. And I can't remember the precise laws, but I don't think that Mexico allows us just to willy-nilly come on in and set up shop, do they? Don't they require that you be a wealthy landowner?
They require that you be a wealthy landowner, and they have armed military at the Guatemalan border, and they do shoot to kill.
How about that? And here we are with our George Bush-created federal department called the Homeland Security, and one of its goals, ostensibly, is to protect the border. They don't do that. They appear to be buying billions of rounds and pregnant women targets, but they're not on the border. What's going on with these guys?
Well, they'd sooner shoot a pregnant white woman that they thought was some sort of extremist than they would shoot a hostile foreign invader, and their record shows that.
It's really pathetic. I don't know how many employees they have, but it's an unconstitutional program founded on complete fallacy of fear, fear-mongering, appeal to fear, and they haven't done the single piece of good. They've been infuriating people with their TSA genital fondling and nudie pictures they take, and they unzip your DNA and zap pregnant women with radiation. They've been nothing but a pain in their you-know-what.
Well, it's a bait and switch. It's always a bait and switch. I was reading. I generally am very critical of Ron Paul and Rand Paul. I really am. But Rand Paul had this article about illegal immigration, about how if we pass the strict illegal immigration thing that a conservative Republican who's serious about border security would want, we won't get what we actually paid for. They'll just use the increased enforcement things against ourselves. They won't actually enforce the border, and they'll just increase the size of this finger quote security state. It's really a terrifying situation where, with the TSA, they install these nudie scanners and they're like, oh, well, don't worry. These will actually be less intrusive because you won't have anybody fondling you. You'll have some professionals in a separate room. Yeah. And sure enough, what happens is, we have these leaked reports that you have a bunch of immature jerks who can see your face, who can see everything.
Yeah.
Pointing and laughing and just being absolutely juvenile, and leaking the pictures and such, with these scanners. So, and with the radiation, they didn't do all their research on that. I think that's still open, but there's just never, you can never press a button on this government machine right now. Yeah. To get what you want out of the vending machine.
I think regarding those scanners, and I would rather take my chances with a terrorist with a box cutter on a plane than to have some bureaucrat with his hand in my pants.
Well, I've joked that I wish there was some kind of airline where there was no security whatsoever. Just somewhere, in case anybody's worried about a hijacking 9/11 style repeat, you could have a button somewhere to blow up the airplane. But, where people just took their chances with the other passengers.
Yeah.
You just walk straight onto the airplane from the parking lot. You sit there beside Abdul, and if you and Abdul need to tango, then, the pilot will lock the door and he'll shoot you if you guys get out of control back there. And everybody, that's the America I grew up, assuming we lived in.
Yeah, sounds reasonable to me. Nobody gets taxed exorbitantly.
Exactly. All these black folks doing the TSA booths. I'm sure the post office could reopen mail on Saturday and give them some jobs there.
Absolutely.
I'm sure there's something we could do with them.
Welcome to the chat room, James Barry, Eric M., and Mickey Henry. And the other 500 people. I'm kidding. One day we'll
not
be
yet.
That popular.
Not yet. One day.
One day. Well, this... The whole Mexican immigration problem takes us back into the Republican issue. And, you wanted to say something, Matt, about the kinism and national anarchism? Was that your point?
It was. I just put that note there to invite people to sort of abandon some traditional assumptions about where winning and losing is. And I think the national anarchist philosophers bring a lot to the table in terms of thinking outside the box. And, with modern communication and transportation technology, I'm not entirely sure that the traditional nation state as we know it is the right way to frame it. Do we need to start thinking more in terms of, compounds of sort of just regions where we take care of our own sort of away from this outside government? Will this government even be there in the future? I have my doubts about its sustainability over the next 25 years. And I guess my bottom line is, rather than panicking about the border, we really don't have any way within the current system. There's no candidate, there's no lever on the ballot to close the border. And, just start thinking of ways that we can preserve our heritage and identity while giving up on that. Because in a way, this whole border security thing is sort of a way to keep a lot of very frustrated working class white people voting Republican with the myth that if they vote Republican hard enough, you know, if they just vote Republican meaner and harder than they did last time, that they'll get their fence, and they won't.
Did you get lambasted by your relatives for not voting this past year? I know I did.
I did too. Yeah. They're like, well, you know, Obama won because of attitudes like yours. And I was just like, I don't care. I really don't. I just assume have a visible, obvious figurehead of the enemy rather than some cheesy, extremely white looking fellow like Mitt Romney up there, making it look like we're in control.
This unusual phenomenon where people are so upset with the gun control for Obama, and then they would have voted for they did vote for Mitt Romney, not even realizing that he banned assault weapons in Massachusetts. And then if they're not complaining about that, they're complaining about Obamacare. Hello, Mitt Romney's Massachusetts model of social health care was what Obama based his off of.
Yeah, it's Romney care. That's what it is. But that also kind of is helpful in my mind, because it really is easy to break that bond between the voters and Obama. And you do see an increasing radicalization because they can't identify with him. He's so alien in manner and appearance and custom and culture that they really see him as an other in a way they've never seen any American president in our history.
That is a good point. Speaking of Republicans, and this is a problem that you and I have talked about, is that one reason we can give up on the Republican Party is there isn't one single Republican alive. And I like Ron Paul. He's heads and shoulders above the rest of them. But not even he will support white folks. He doesn't believe in a homeland for whites. He doesn't believe in our basic kinist position. And is there ever going to be a Republican that does?
Oh, well, I don't think within the current system they can. You know, they're in the pocket of the corporations, and I think this entire Democratic framework, if you believe in Democratic Republics in the first place, which I don't, they can only work and have only been shown to work for the brief periods that they've ever worked in a relatively homogenous, stable, cohesive society. And you know what wouldn't work in some place like Finland? I would like to do an experiment where they do like 5 years of Finland under extreme communism and then under extreme anarchism and just watch as each time around the Finnish people are happy, healthy, well-educated, and going about their business. Just to kind of prove to people that a lot of these political and ideological things don't matter as much as, you know, your tribe, your people, and your traditions as well.
President Obama, here's a piece, and I'll quote, the president has made clear that he believes common sense reform needs to include strengthening border security, creating an earned path to citizenship, holding employers accountable, and streamlining legal immigration. And here he's appealing to Rubio, McCain, and Graham. I guess I don't know much about their position on immigration. I think I know more about McCain's, but I assume they are fence sitters and he needs their votes or something.
Well, they're the Gang of Eight. It was their idea to attempt this whole amnesty thing over again. You know, and that it really is Republicans who are pushing for this amnesty harder than Obama is.
Last I heard, John McCain has a position of completely open borders now, right?
I mean they have their little thing about, well, they got to pay taxes,
sure.
Because it's all about money. The whole immigration thing is entirely about money. Well, that's how most Americans now even think about politics. They just, you know, when you try to talk to them about Detroit, it's not about the money.
Yeah. I saw your picture on Facebook today of Detroit, which was once a very booming city of ingenuity, And now it's dregs. It's in ruins. And the difference is what? They didn't practice the libertarian principle of non-aggression properly.
Yeah. Well, the post, the original post was that, Detroit's a Democrat city.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
That was their thing. It's like, you know, they voted Democrat and that's what happened. And I asked, trolling perhaps, you know, then why is Portland so prosperous? Not to say that I'm far from a leftist or whatever, but you do have to point these things out, that these liberal secular places are prosperous. They're not violent. In the same way, when you bring black people in, you're going to have that sort of depravity that we simply can't handle, and we can do nothing but flee from it.
I don't know much about Marco Rubio, other than he's part Mexican, and he seems to be popular now in the Republican camp. And
that was he's Cuban. He's a white Cuban.
Okay. Cubans, Mexicans, whatever. But I can just see this 2016 Rand Paul and Marco Rubio on the ticket, trying to use Ron Paul's influence. Now you get his son, the libertarian principles, plus you get the appeal to the Mexican base to get more Republican voters in the Mexican community. I think I will shoot myself in the head if that happens. Because sure enough, my family members will punch that Chad, as it were, and then punch me for not doing the same thing.
Well, I have a more sadistic approach where I'm no longer emotionally invested in it, and will take a certain amount of delight in watching them get their hopes up and having their hopes dashed again. You know, and I have seen over the past 10 years, friends and family have incrementally moved over to my side. And, you know, it's usually has less to do with a point I made or whatever. You know, our case is a relatively simple one, and you know, people know what our case is. They talk around it or whatever, pretend, you know, feign stupidity. But they know that our case is out there, and after enough abuse by the Republican Party, they eventually wake up. So, you know, not always and not all of them, but I don't mind that sort of cruel abuse of the voter, because I think that works in our favor in the long run.
This next item I have in the show notes is that Colin Powell, Dick Cheney, and Laura Bush plead support for sodomites. And there's an article, I'll probably post it in the chat room, but Robert Finkelfin was on last week talking about, one of the things he mentioned was the low morality in the military. And it doesn't matter what happens, you know, don't ask, don't tell gets reversed. They allow women in open combat. And where are the moral folks and the officers and so forth speaking up, standing down and so forth? You don't see it. And here we are, these former Republican leaders, and even the Republican Party is almost as liberal when it comes to these social issues like homosexuality as the Democrats are. It's getting pathetic.
Well, I think Greg Johnson summed it up well when he explained that Republicans are liberals. They're just slower. They're the sort of less intelligent kid in the class who's struggling to keep up, but they're moving in the same direction.
Yeah, that's really it. The old, I've heard today's Republicans or today's conservatives are yesterday's liberals, and even was it Dabney or Thornwell, one of the Calvinist guys from the Civil War era, said something right on to the same point, that's the way conservatism works. I think it was Dabney. I should probably.
That sounds like Dabney.
Yeah, they are reactionary rather than patently principled and offensive. They're just they're reactionary.
Well, and sometimes they even slip up and say things like, you know, America's not ready for that, which, you know, reveals just for a split second the incrementalist leftist mindset. They're not opposed to completely reinventing marriage to include every perversion under the sun. They're just opposed to it yet. You know, America's not there yet. Or, yep. You know, we need more time to adjust to the last round of perversions.
Yeah, I've always despised that type of argumentation. We're just not ready for that. It's the same thing as, I mean, what's the difference between that and the progressive principle where ethics are really determined by just ebb and flow of popular opinion rather than principles? It's pathetic.
Well, you know, once you've decided there is no God, or you've redefined him to not be a him, to be some vague metaphorical architect or whatever, you know, where does morality come from? It comes from the self. And the more intelligent children in the class, once they realize that you yourself, the human, you're, as a humanist, are the source of morality, if you're sharp, you realize, wait, that means I don't really have defects. I just have virtues which are being persecuted. And you know, every defect about you, whether it's homosexuality or greed or whatever, you can just flip that around because you are the sole source of truth and justice and right and wrong. There's nothing above you. You're above everything. And the smarter kids follow that to its conclusion, that whatever your defect is suddenly a virtue. And the slower kids, it takes them a little longer, but they eventually get there.
Mickey Henry is right on top of things as always. He posted the quote from Dabney. It's up in an article on countercurrents.com, and I'll just quote it, just to put it on audio here. American conservatism is merely the shadow that follows radicalism as it moves forward towards perdition. It remains behind it but never retards it and always advances near its leader. Its impotency is not hard, indeed, to explain. It is worthless because it is the conservatism of expediency only and not of sturdy principle. It intends to risk nothing serious for the sake of truth and has no idea of being guilty of the folly of martyrdom. So exactly what I said, but much, much, much more eloquently. Dabney, he was writing then in the 18... I guess that's somewhere between 60 and 1880, I would imagine. I should know my Dabney better. But that was then, this is now. As was, so is. Did we lose you, Matt? We did. Well, who needs Matt? We'll just continue without him. Now let me try to get him back on here. There's a problem with the call. Hold on while we try to get the call back. Okay, we'll just wait for Matt to come back on. But what we want to talk about now is, rather than the problems and what's going bad, what is the leadership required to restore the health of real Americans, of true America? Do we need a charismatic leader? A new party, you know, a third party? Do we need just more of the same, more grassroots stuff, more podcasts, more blogs, more radio shows? What is the answer to this? And Matt's going to tell us. You there, Matt?
Yes, I'm back. Sorry about that.
Did you have to refill your bourbon?
Yeah. Well, I couldn't tell you the actual reason because Linux has never crashed on me before. It's the Skype program because yeah. Linux wouldn't crash.
That is true. I will admit that.
I'll blame Skype on that one.
I was asking what needs to happen in terms of solutions. Where is the leadership? Do we need more grassroots stuff, a charismatic leader, a new party? Have you thought much about that?
Well, I have, of course. We all have. And, I mean, yeah, I think we need a charismatic leader. I think there needs to be a spark, that magic, that, you know, Excalibur. And it's not me. And I don't see anybody who it obviously is at this point. But there needs to be a Frankenstein there waiting for that lightning bolt. And that's what I see what I'm doing, just trying to build up the infrastructure, get the ideas out there, lay the organizational fundamentals, you know, the foolishness of repetitive preaching, and so on. You know, if you don't have all the answers, it's not necessarily wise to just kind of thrash about and desperately try different angles. I know time, time isn't infinite, but I think there's also a harm to be done in desperately flailing about at extreme solutions under the pretext that we've got to do something, I think the best thing we can do is just continue this kind of stuff and brainstorming, working together, and building relationships. I think that's very critical. Getting to know other people of like mind in person, too, at a local level, I think is much bigger than it seems like or feels like.
Those are good points. I know that last time we had a current events show, Scott Terry co-hosted with me, and we brought Matthew Heim back on. And he had the same question about whether we need a leader. Of course, Scott Terry wanted him to be that leader, and he said, I will not accept. So I don't know how that's going to happen, but I agree. We need somebody who can at least be charismatic enough to popularize the message. But one of the big things I see is a problem, and I always talk about this, and Tom Hengist and I talked about it and over his show on National Socialism, is we have to find a way to get people off of the electronic synagogue, as it were. They're just addicted to propaganda and disinformation and misinformation. That's part of the problem is stopping the bombardment. Before you can learn, you have to unlearn, and there's no way to unlearn until we can unhook these people. You agreed?
Well, I think that's partially true. I know from my own experience when I've been between jobs or at a rather boring job, the mind sort of crusts whenever it's very well fed and very comfortable. And that's part of what I was talking about, my sadistic streak earlier. The Golden Dawn is succeeding in Greece because their currency is collapsing, because the government is failing. The difference between a fat, boring tomcat that would just let a mouse sit on top of it and a cat that's a mouser is the automated feeder. And, as long as this government appears to be working, we have a real uphill battle. It's really impressive we have anybody listening to us, given how the assumption is that this government will continue giving people millions of jobs, passing out these food stamps, increasing the number of these food stamps and other benefits, all these workfare programs, all these, with the post office and the black employees, all these different things. And everybody just assumes those will go on forever. And, I don't think we should give up on the cat until, the automated feeder's empty.
I guess I'm not making the connection between that and the mainline media.
Well, that's what I'm saying is the connection there is that they will allow themselves to be manipulated by the media. They'll fall for the dumbest arguments because they're comfortable. And I think no matter how hard the propaganda is, if they start struggling to feed themselves, if they start having to make really tough choices in their personal lives because they're hitting rock bottom, I think a lot of these propagandistic points about pitying the poor refugee make a whole lot more sense. When you're well fed and in a nice climate controlled room,
I got
than when you're out there struggling.
So there's really no pulling them off until the austerity really sets in hard, right?
That's my working hypothesis. Yeah, I mean we can. That's not an excuse to stop trying. And even if there was absolutely no hope, we can still use that time between now and then to get better at it. So that what I fear is that the currency will collapse next week, and we won't have anybody groomed to step up and seize that opportunity and back into geeks like myself who enjoy doing the web design and doing a lot of the organizational back end work won't have our stuff in order to prop that man up. That's what I fear, that people will have ears to hear and we won't have our megaphone working.
Got it. We certainly need that. We certainly need to work on on building an infrastructure. Of course, you always fear about the government, you know, buttoning it up and pushing the shutdown button on the internet, which has been very tremendously helpful for us and our cause.
Well, I mean, we need to be smarter about that too. We need to be sending PGP encrypted emails. We need to be using CryptoCat. We need to, you know, be hosting these things on our own servers and not just, you know, waking up and hoping that there's not some sort of terms of service violation that puts a stop to whatever we're doing. And they're smart. Do you remember Andrew Yeoman, the national anarchist?
I don't.
Okay, well, he sort of dropped out of that scene, and he's been very heavily into what's called crypto-anarchism.
Okay.
And I've been sort of researching that, too, among the too many things I've got myself interested in. And, you know, if the fight goes there, if they try to, finger quote, shut down the internet, then we need to know how to use the Onion Router stuff, and we need to figure out some way that the geeks can connect with the people who aren't geeks to make the tools and resources accessible to our audience. And that's, you know, that's part of making the megaphone work, is making it to where it'll work even if the government wants to turn it off.
So I shouldn't have sent you my show notes using Google Drive.
Well, you might as well have. I mean, it is a handy resource, and that's the thing, is finding that balance.
Yep.
Between leveraging these free tools like Google and Facebook. Is Facebook is this massive audience of receptive people, and yet you've got, it's entirely owned by this Jew, and they constantly censor. So, you know, do you just get off of Facebook? Do you try to dance on that line? You know, these are the tough questions that we have to, you know, and I think to some extent we need to answer yes to all the above. Have it to where we have some of our people out there dancing around on Facebook, some of them, you know, playing with their cards closer to the chest, you know, and all in between.
I want to talk about the role of religion and our new America. But before that, I should have studied up on this. I was going to, but I didn't. Perhaps you could give our listeners just a brief synopsis of what Golden Dawn is over there in Greece, because I haven't been following it. Mickey Henry told me about it, and I should have known, but I don't know. Can you help us out here?
Well, Golden Dawn is a political party in Greece that's pretty much explicitly fascist. Their symbol is in a very sort of reminiscent of a fascist style. They are national socialist, or social nationalist, if you will. They're not conservative in the same way that, like, American Republicans are, as far as libertarianism and such. They believe in, you know, fighting for and helping the working poor. And, you know, that's... they're having a lot of success in the wake of this austerity crisis, because you have all these Greeks whose previous livelihoods have been pulled out from under them, and you have this immigration wave. And when people are forced to compete with hostile immigrants face-to-face on the street, and this is getting back to what I said earlier, they have an epiphany that never seems to hit them when you're arguing with logic at the dinner table. You know, no matter how well you frame your case, it always falls short of actually fighting over a loaf of bread with some angry Somalian with wild, you know, sclerotic eyes. So the Golden Dawn has been very successful, racking up some double-digit successes over there. And what's really phenomenal, I think this might segue somewhat into what's so exciting about Kristen and Nicole getting involved and sharing our ideas, is the Golden Dawn is almost as popular among women in polling as it is among men. And as you know, it's a constant refrain in you know, the white advocacy movement, where are the women at? And I think this proves the point I've tried to make, which is that the women know a hobby project that's not going to amount to anything when they see it. They know when the boys are just off playing games, and they don't have any use for it. And when the Golden Dawn is actually out there protecting women, and they do. They meet these immigrant gangs on the street, yeah, and they fight back. They wage street battles and stuff like this. They're totally alien to anything that white advocacy movement can even imagine doing at this point. Yeah. And, you know, it may not be appropriate for our context, but whatever. The women see them as truly, not just rhetorically, not just in the abstract, as protecting them.
Yes.
As helping feed them.
And at the end of the show, we'll get to that, the audio with Kristen and Nicole, but I might as well play a relevant clip now about what you just said, and that is women have the ability to know when we're just talking and not doing anything, so we'll play this brief clip here.
Excellent. We do what needs to be done, and we're very disheartened by the amount of talk that comes out of other kinists, but the lack of action. Everyone is in debates about where things should be, what should go on, who should be where, who's got the better philosophy, and we're just like, man, this is a waste of your energy. Just go out and do it. If you know what needs to be done, do it. You don't have to think about it beyond that. Just, I mean, the word is the word. If you're Christian, you're going to go and do what God says to do.
So, Matt, quit
Amen.
Talking and do something, man. Yeah, I was really pleased to hear them put that video out, and we'll get to all those clips. Not the whole thing, but I just took about four or five clips that are, I thought, were relevant. But yeah, we do need to start thinking about more action and more and less talk. And it's easier to say than do. One of my immediate practical kinist goals is to get myself and my family out of the city. I don't think the cities are really the best place to be in our time and place. Maybe in a good, sane nation, but we're not a sane nation either by its makeup or economically. And so I would love to move into a central location where all my kinist buddies are, but it doesn't work out. It's not that easy. I've got obligations because I am a kinist to my mom and my dad and my others and my other family members. And so that's something you guys, my listeners, can think about is what can you do, you know, for your mom and dad rather than just bailing out and trying to be with your buddies.
Well, and that's I've heard that argued convincingly both ways. I don't have a clear answer for that. To some extent, you know, it does make sense to start out where you already have roots, where you already have credibility, and you know, I think a lot of it's as simple as, you know, not necessarily leading with our message, because our message sort of is pretty loud even when we whisper it. So to repeat it can be abrasive. To just say, you know what, I'm in this because you guys are my folk, you guys are my community, and I'm here for you. And then to just demonstrate that stewardship on a daily basis in your neighborhood, and to be the sort of person that if times did get hard, people would intuitively and instinctively and naturally turn to you for answers.
Sorry. My mic was turned down. I was typing. Trying to man the chat room. Well, let's talk about the role of religion. I think Christianity should be the religion. I think Christians aren't going to be Christians unless... Well, let me back up. Christians need to rule if they're going to have the blessings of a Christian existence. Boy, that didn't come out very well, but do you know what I mean?
Oh, I fully agree.
We always complain about the social problems that are anti-Christian. It's hard to do anything about it if the Christians themselves aren't leading. That's what I meant.
Right. Yeah, and just leading in theory isn't good enough either. We have to actually be taking social risks and wasting our free time and stuff like that in, you know, service and projects like that, and in preparation, and in demonstrating Christian stewardship. I think, you know, that's the message that resonates most strongly when I read the Gospels, and that's you know, humble stewardship. And that's not just an idea. That's something that needs to be put into practice, as Kristen and Nicole put it.
Yeah. Mickey Henry says about Golden Dawn that they want to avoid the austerity measures and keep the bread and circuses rolling to the Greeks. Is there an aspect of welfareism built into that party?
Yeah. And there's an aspect of welfareism built into Matt Parrott as well. I'm not a libertarian conservative. I believe the government can play an important role, especially in a post-industrial, post-worker age, where I think the position of saying that people who are starving and struggling are immoral and need to pick themselves up by their bootstraps is an awful position to take right before economic circumstances crush our people, drive our middle class. And right now, all these upper middle class Tea Party people can act like starving and struggling and not being able to find work is due to moral depravity. And, you know, in a very up economy like we've had the last few decades, there's some truth to that. Back in the 90s, you kind of had to be sort of a bit of a loser, maybe, to not be able to hold a middle-class job or whatever. But that's not as much the case now, and it's certainly not going to be the case in the future. And I'm not going to be giving people the message that I'm not going to help them, and that the government, that my leadership is not going to help. I don't see that as cake and circuses.
Yeah, we had Tom Hengist on, and we talked about Germany's national socialism of the 30s and 40s, and it got me rethinking some things, because I could probably see temporarily a government being for its people and using its resources to get them back on their feet, not as a permanent system, but as a way of getting them strong again, rather than, as you said, just letting them pull themselves up by their own bootstraps. But at the same time, I think in my bones is this anti-centralist thing. So I'm still thinking these things through. Mickey says that he believes that they just wanted to break from the Eurozone so they can inflate their own currency.
Well, the Golden Dawn movement's been around a whole lot longer than this whole currency crisis thing. They've certainly exploited it in the fashion he's describing, but that's not their motives. And that's not what the people on the ground, I don't think that's what they're seeing. Yeah, and you know, is it fair to the German government what they're doing? You know, I don't know, and there certainly is all sort of, there are international political dimensions that we can't fully explore in this context. A lot of the arguments being, you know, valid or whatever.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'm going to side with the ethnic nationalist Christians fighting in the street for their people.
Got it. Yeah, I should know more about that. I wasn't trying to start a fight between you and Mickey. Although I do love to start fights.
And I love to bicker.
Okay, well, let's bicker about
without malice.
Yeah, exactly. Anything more regarding the role of religion in America? I think I have on the outline. What's the relationship between Christians and non-Christians in terms of working together in leadership positions?
I mean, in my ideal scenario, you have an explicitly Christian sort of a soft monarchy, basically a theocracy. And the government itself is explicitly, openly, and proudly Christian. And I would even insist that it be a particular denomination, but I certainly don't want to cause any undue and unnecessary strife at this point with that particular point. But as far as unbelievers and skeptics and whatever, outside of the vanguard, I think they should be tolerated. I think the traditional tolerance for what, you know, and respect for privacy, and you know, I think ultimately somebody's faith has to be a decision of an intimate personal decision, and if it's forced on them by the government, I don't think that's truly faith. I wouldn't be for forcing everybody to become, you know, a Christian. And, you know, if somebody's skeptical, I think, you know, we should try to convert them, you know, with reason and compassion and such. But, yeah, I think there's a way for it to be a confidently and explicitly Christian kingdom while still being a place that's welcoming and comfortable for the Americans who need some time to grow back into their Christian heritage.
You didn't say anything I disagree with. I think that's true. There's a public policy, and there can be crimes that are definitely religious in nature that can be punished if they take place in the public square. But what you do in your closet is up to you. And I don't believe in forcing anybody to, you know, be baptized or whatever. In fact, I always get this criticism. Somebody posted on my Facebook wall not too long ago about, you guys just want to go convert everybody, and if you don't convert them, you want to kill them and bonfire them. It's just ridiculous character of our position.
Well, they're projecting because that's what the leftists always do when they defeat their enemies.
I don't want to be ruled by sodomites. I don't want to be ruled by Jews. I don't want to be ruled by Muslims. But, you know, if you have the Book of Quran in your bedroom, it's not my business. But if it is a Christian nation, we should be able to set a position that says you cannot publicly, out in the open, proselytize to your false god, because it would be seen as antithetical to the foundation of the social order.
Right, or having the Muslim prayer call echoing through my hometown.
Yeah.
I don't believe that's going to happen on my watch. But I think an important thing is to remember that this is really sort of a first-past-the-post thing here. Rather than telling the neo-pagans or the atheist human biodiversity types that, no, we will take it, I think if we grab the flag first, and I think we will, you know, I believe strongly enough in my faith that I believe it is what will empower us to defeat our enemies. I think it will empower us to be more bold, to make greater sacrifices. You know, I think martyrdom will come more easily to us. You know, and I pray I'll have the courage to make whatever sacrifices on behalf of my God and my people I need to make.
Amen.
But yeah, I don't think somebody who's really just in this for the white supremacy, because they found out that we have more IQ points than black people. You know, is that really something to die for? And you see them all the time. They get outed on their blog and then they recant because, you know, this isn't worth losing their job over. This isn't, you know, this is just a hobby.
Yeah.
You know, and I believe, and I may be proven wrong here. I hope I'm not, that we, we'll take the lead, not by kicking back or kicking down other white advocates, but just by running faster and harder.
Yeah, I've gotten some feedback from white nationalists. In fact, that's why I did the first Kenism FAQ, which was entitled "Is Christianity Jewish?" Because the main criticism coming from other white advocates to us Christians is, well, you guys have a Jewish savior and a Jewish religion and a Jewish history. And of course, it's all built on theological and even anthropological misconceptions. So I wanted to address that. But there are some that are a lot easier to work with and who aren't vitriolically opposed to working with us. But I still choose to be specifically Christian. And I don't think that the way forward is to elevate one's race to the level of a deity, which ultimately is what a non-Kenist form of white nationalism is. And I think that the administrator of Spirit, Water, Blood got into that debate with Alex Linder and said, look, that you white nationalists, without Christianity and without Christ as your savior, you are your own religion. Your biology is your God. And that's a point that needs to be made, I believe.
Right. Well, and that would be different if those who thought their biology was their god had a demonstrable history or promise of stewardship. And, you know, I think there's a sort of a selfish...
That's a good point.
Ragnar Redbeardian theme that sort of runs through some of that white supremacism. Yeah. Feel awkward arguing against white supremacism. Well, yeah, on the other side of the table for a change, I guess. But yeah. You know, I just don't see them as being as willing to make the kind of sacrifices we're going to have to make here to win. You know, I don't. You know, they don't. You know, not to pick a fight here, but they don't have as many children as traditionalist Christians do. They're not married as often. A lot of times they, you know, indulge in various counterproductive lifestyles and stuff like that that just aren't as conducive to victory, frankly.
I agree.
And you know, if that's not the case, then prove me wrong. You know, run out in front of me. Make me look like a fool by proving to me that you can, you know, defeat the enemy. You know, I think that's the best way, you know, to to referee this fight is to say, hey, you know, our people need rescued. You know, you go do it if you don't think we can do it.
I wanted to cover a few more, I guess you could say, lighthearted stories before we get into the audio clips. I don't want to spend a lot of time on this, but there is I saw an article that came across my feed, Death from Swarm of Tiny Drones. U.S. Air Force releases terrifying video of tiny flybots that can hover, stalk, and even kill targets. And that just gives you warm, fuzzy feelings all over, doesn't it?
I just wonder what that's all going to come to. Whether people will freak out. You know, because we do have these instinctive things against plagues and against swarms, whether it's from insects, you know, for evolutionary reason, the idea of this sort of invasive infestation is something that really reaches to the back of the mind and, you know, makes your skin crawl. The idea of the government having like a cockroach or even smaller sized cameras that can crawl in your house and monitor you. And, you know, that's not science fiction. That's stuff they're working on.
Yeah, it's out there. It makes you sick to your stomach to think that they're so absorbed with intrusion. And are there really any homeland terrorists at all? I mean, I've read reports where what they're looking for are so-called extremists, which could be anything from, you know, Liberty Ron Paul fans to single-issue pro-lifers to agrarians and self-sufficient people, preppers. I mean, come on, are these really terrorists?
Well, a lot of times they just make them up to meet their quota. They find somebody who's not that bright. They're like, hey, I've got a farm. We've got some fertilizer. And it's like, oh, yay. And then they go along with it because they're dumb. And they meet their quota. You do have... they have to manufacture these excuses to exist.
Excuse me. Yeah, well, I just wanted to mention that story so all my viewers and listeners can... prepare by loading up with birdshot for your shotguns and just pop those suckers out of the sky when you see them. Here's a story. South Indiana school to apologize for racist costumes. Officials at a predominantly white middle school in southern Indiana plan to apologize for costumes students wore to a basketball game that sparked allegations of racism.
Now, you mentioned this at the top of the hour, I believe.
I did?
Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't go into the details, though.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I do. If there are more details, please do.
Yeah,
check.
Yeah. I was just at the beginning. I was summarizing what we're going to get into.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
okay.
Let's see. I can read the relevant parts here.
Yeah.
The New Albany, Floyd County Consolidated School Corporation officials said Monday that they'll write a letter of apology to Parkview Middle School for the costumes. A handful of students at the district's middle school, they wore black masks, including a gorilla mask, and one featuring President Barack Obama's likeness to a February 7th, 8th grade basketball game between the schools. And the parents of some of the students at Parkview, I'm guessing you could presume upon their race, a Jefferson Middle School with several African-American students and basketball players questioned if racism was involved. So there you go. You wear a gorilla mask, and it's immediately racist because gorillas look like blacks, I guess. And
so I do admit the Barack Obama gorilla costume. I see how they could be going, you know, with that. I remember New Albany. It might actually be the school. It's really when I was in fourth grade. It was my first real introduction to black people. To be honest, I went there for a media fair program, and I remember sitting in the cafeteria, and I was so nice to them, and they were all just so mean. it was a very startling experience for me.
You know, to be fair, I had Barack Obama pegged for more like a monkey because of the big ears.
He's definitely more chimpanzee-ish than gorilla-ish, absolutely. If anything, John McCain's sort of gorilla-ish.
He really is. John McCain, yeah. And like you mentioned at the top of the hour, there are white folks who do have primate features. So why don't whites get up and go, hey, I need you to write me a letter of apology because that was against my granddad, John McCain. Oh, boy. What else, Mr. Parrott? We've got...
Well, I wanted to mention real quick, this is the civil rights struggle where it's at now. This is the new frontier in the civil rights movement. Choosing the race of your nurse. This has become sort of a scandal because they're finding out that in some nursing homes, some of the elderly people... actually are for whatever reason, whether it be to senility or wisdom or whatever, would prefer a nurse of a specific race or to not have, you know, a black nurse or whatever. Or maybe the Mexican nurses, they can't understand them or whatever. And, you know, this is, you know, when I'm talking to a grown man about these racial issues, it's always frustrating to me because we're never really the ones who suffer. I can hold my own in downtown Indianapolis just fine. But, you know, what about these children who ride the bus and get attacked, intimidated, and threatened every day when they go to these inner city schools? And what about these elderly people who are completely vulnerable and helpless at the mercy of these people? And you hear about these just awful crimes, and there will be more as, you know, we have all these baby boomers retiring and we have all these immigrants and minorities in the healthcare profession. There's only going to be more of this sort of abuse and terror and discomfort there. And the idea that, like, an adult medical professional's feelings matter more than the safety and security and wishes of an elderly woman in a nursing home, I just find that revolting.
Yeah.
I mean, could you imagine if you were a nurse and there were a black woman, and when you walked in, she was like, huh, you know, he's going to lynch me or whatever. you know, would you be all like, no, I'm going to be your nurse. Yeah. I don't care how scared you are, because I have a right to be your nurse, and you're going to deal with it, you senile old lady. You know... I couldn't do that. I'd feel terrible for her and, you know, feel awful that she thought that, you know, I was going to lynch her or whatever and try to find another medical professional who could help her.
Yeah, I agree.
It's just sick to me.
I posted a link to that article in the chat room from Winston-Salem Journal, by the way.
Okay.
Very interesting. I mentioned at the top of the hour the hundreds of thousands of Christians marched in Puerto Rico against gay rights, and I won't spend much more time on that, but I just want people to think about when is the last time you've seen hundreds of thousands of white Christians in America protest social issues at all. They're too busy at home watching House of Cards or American Idol or whatever the hell is popular these days to do any kind of political protests. In fact, Matt, you and I have done some work downtown Indy regarding the... It was the Arizona-style anti-immigration legislation that Senator Mike Delf was proposing, and it was an abysmal turnout.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it was good that the people did turn out, but it of course, that's probably not as Christians are going to fight the gays before they fight for their own race, but still, whites just don't get active politically.
Right. Well, we can be smarter about it. I thought what was funny was we were the only ones holding signs up to the street. So you had like this large mass of these, you know, pro-immigration protesters walking around in a little circle. And you had our signs up to the street. So I just think that people passing by thought we had this massive multiracial march, yeah, you know, against immigration.
That was a cold day, wasn't it?
Oh, it was freezing.
It was freezing. You guys can do a YouTube search for SB 590 Indianapolis rally and see the YouTube videos. And yours truly was doing the camera work.
Yep.
And Matt has a speech at the end of one of those videos.
That bill delivered before a massive audience.
Yeah, a massive audience. That bill, it was gutted, wasn't it?
Well, you know, and that's you know, part of my radicalization is we ended up getting that passed, and then the Republican leadership under Mitch Daniels and Attorney General Zoller, yeah, and just the entire enforcement mechanism. You know, not one Latino hair has been affected. Not one illegal immigrant, I don't think I have any evidence for, has been affected by the work we've done. It doesn't, you know, you're just splashing water upstream when you try to work within the mainstream political context. And that's why, you know, with this McCain-Rubio amnesty thing here, I'm just not... I just don't trust this government enough to even fight within the system anymore. And I can't, in good faith, encourage other people to fight within the system and vote Republican harder and louder.
Yeah. Do you want to talk anything about this is Tribal Theocrat Live, by the way. Matt Parrott, the guest, talking about current issues. I'm Christian Gray. Did you want to mention, Matt, anything about the latest front and gun debate regarding the mandatory insurance?
Oh, yeah. That's the new twist on that. That goes back to the point I was just making about how it doesn't matter if you have a Second Amendment. If the people in the government don't care about the letter or the spirit, it doesn't matter. You know, because they'll find some sneaky way, like creating some insurance that you're required. Oh, well, of course you have your Second Amendment right to guns, but do you have the, you know, $800 a year or whatever? It could be astronomical for all we know in special insurance. Yeah, you know, and that's what they did. That's what they're doing to tobacco right now, to de facto outlaw it. It's the same nanny state style thing, but you know they'll just find even if they can't, you know, legislatively, and that's how they've done with the illegal immigration thing. They tried to pass an amnesty, the Dream Act. They didn't get it. They tried again. They didn't get it. And finally, they're like, okay, forget this whole legislation thing. The Dream Act is passed. Ta-da! And that's exactly what they did. So why all that fighting against the Dream Act if, you know, the whole thing is just a dress rehearsal for what they're going to do anyway?
Don't you love how over the top they are in these euphemistic names they assign to pieces of legislation, like the Dream Act? I mean, my goodness, that's a complete nightmare for us, not a dream. Or the Patriot Act. So I guess it's anti-American to be for the Fourth Amendment? Ridiculous. And the
are you voting against the Patriot Act?
How dare you vote against the Patriot Act?
Can't vote against patriotism.
You're against Mexicans fulfilling their dreams?
Yes, actually. If their dream is to take my birthright, then yeah.
Man, that son of a bitch, Dick Lugar, Republican from Indiana, was a huge Dream Act guy. Wasn't he one of the co-sponsors?
Yeah, he was a co-sponsor, and he's so bitter about his loss. Especially given how the what's-his-face ended up losing the general election, which I don't care. I'm just glad Lugar lost. I won when Lugar lost. I don't care what the general election was.
Man, hard to believe he was in office in 76 and did nothing for Hoosiers.
Yeah, he's done nothing for Hoosiers. He's a global statesman. You know, he's too busy, you know, worrying about Israel and, you know, Africa, and he's, you know, he just doesn't have time for Indiana.
Good times. Bad times. Well, we have next on our show notes. Oh, I wanted to mention something. I asked the chat room people if they wanted to see us cover anything because you were so brilliant off the cuff, Matt. And someone mentioned off-the-grid communities, and I know you and I have talked about that. And in fact, I was chatting with you one time about, hey, Matt, you need to get a semi-automatic rifle. And you think, you know, maybe so, but I probably will be better off, given the nature of fourth-generation warfare, learning a set of valuable skills where I can disappear and completely live off the grid and generate a subsistent income. I thought that was a good point. That really resonates with me now. Do you have anything you want to say about off-the-grid communities?
Well, I just think that's the way we've got to be going. You know, there's this commons, okay, that the government feeds off of, that these immigrants feed off of, that these minorities feed off of, and that these decadent white leftists and anti-Christians feed off of. We need to disconnect psychologically, socially, economically from that grid. And that's an incremental process. I'm not telling anybody to load everything in their van and head for the hills to live off berries. You know, it's just a gradual thing of finding ways that you can be less participatory in this system, because when you're putting your work into this commons, you're helping feed it, and it must be starved. You know, we must unplug from it. We've got to find our own ways to entertain ourselves independent of the media. And, you know, I think, you know, in Idaho and in Montana, and you're seeing this independent of really any right-wing movement. You're seeing more and more white people just going off to remote rural enclaves and doing things like telecommuting. I would encourage a young person to find some job like an auto mechanic or a computer programmer, something where you've got a truly portable skill. That's the way I like to put it, is the kind of skill, the kind of vocation where even if the guy doesn't like you, he's still going to hire you. You know, if your toilet's overflowing and the guy who's the best plumber in the county has a swastika tattoo on his butt while he's working on it, if you're in a real crisis, you're going to choose the guy. But, you know, if you go into, like, being a social worker or trying to be a teacher in the school system or whatever, those are the kinds of occupations where you're fixed in a specific place, yeah, where you have to, no matter where your heart leads you, you have to parrot the appropriate dogma, or you'll just be pushed out of the way. And, you know, just the little things like relying less on consumer goods, buying less stupid toys. And, yeah, you know, if you've got extra money, invest it in sustainability, in putting some solar panels on top of your house, or, you know, what have you.
Good advice. We conservatives, you know, we like capitalism, but we make a lot of dumb decisions with our resources, don't we?
Oh, yeah.
Just because you can buy it doesn't mean you should buy it.
Right. And that's been a real evolution for me over the last 5 years, is skepticism about capitalism as an ideal. I mean, that will to be successful or whatever is a huge force, and could be a force for good, but it has no moral context. And the current context, capitalism is almost always a vice. You know, it's always pushing against our people right now. It doesn't have to be that way, and capitalism, like I said, can be a huge force for good, and it's something, you know, but it's like water. You can drown in it, you can create life from it, but it's just a force. It has no, like libertarians like to imagine it as this sort of, you know, wonderful thing that makes everything better, and that's not the case. These multinational corporations, these Wall Street banksters, these hedge fund managers and the mortgage market and everything, these are strangling our people.
They really are.
And the Mexicans aren't the ones lobbying for illegal immigration. You know, it's not like you have these people wandering out of the fields and in broken English begging the senators to give them amnesty. You have major agribusiness networks. You have the Chamber of Commerce. You have these sinister multinational corporations and capitalists saying, hey, we want to pay workers less. We want to have more of these workers that we don't have to properly take care of.
Yeah. How many libertarians does it take to change a light bulb? There's a question from the chat room.
How many?
None. The free market will do it. Free market, free market, free market. That's the god of the system, isn't it?
Yep.
I listen to some libertarians, and they've got no concept, or if they do, they're too cowardly to talk about it, of just the race question. I heard someone the other day, I'm not sure if it was Lou Rockwell or might have been Alex Jones. He's like, I don't care if you're black, white, or Mexican, or colored, or Jewish. All I care about is if you believe in private property and the Second Amendment. So that's it for them. Private property, Second Amendment, free market, non-aggression, one big multicolored mess.
Tomorrow, when your kids wake up, you should just be like, yeah, I don't care who your parents are. Yeah. I don't care where you're from. I don't care where you consider home. You know, the kid who's best able to clean that room.
That's right.
Is the kid who's going to be my kid. And if, you know, another kid walks in here and can do a better job of cleaning this room and doing these chores, you know, that's going to be my new kid.
Good analogy. That's what it comes down to. The arguments for our position are so simple and so, yet so powerful.
Right.
So powerful.
Well, they pretend to ignore it. You know, they pretend to not get it because getting it is taboo. You know, it's socially, you know, I got last week, I was bragging about it perhaps too much, but I ended up on the front page of Reddit, you know, with the stupid meme I created on a whim. And, you know, I used that attention, having those, you know, tens of thousands of people looking at it to make a pro-white comment, sort of a bait and switch. And I ended up, because that's trolling, I ended up, now I can't even comment on Reddit anymore. But what was funny was all the counter arguments were variations on the theme of, don't you know that that's the ignorant, unfashionable position to have?
Yeah,
that's, you know, it. Don't you, you know, didn't you get the memo that smart people believe the other way?
It's smart and trendy to exterminate yourself, Matt. Get with the program.
Yeah, and they can't think outside their paradigm. It's the same way with libertarians and economics. You know, you say, well, even if having open borders is better for the economy, I don't want it. You know, that sort of does not compute. You know, they short circuit. They don't know where to go from there because their minds are just totally one tracked onto economics, you know, and on Reddit, it's all about social fashion. You know, it's like, yeah, I know it's not socially fashionable, but I still believe it's true. And they're like, that makes you a retard. And I'm like, no, you, even if I'm a retard, you know, for believing this, I'd rather be a retard who believes this. But that totally, you know, cause I don't know.
The arguments, the so-called rebuttals of our position are so pathetic that do they even deserve a response? Here's one from, let me get to it here. You know, on the tribaltheocrat.com, I have the Celtic cross as, I'm not sure if you saw this, but somebody commented on my Facebook wall about the comment. It says, gee, thanks a lot for co-opting the Celtic cross. And then I said, gee, I didn't know the Celtic cross ever stood for pluralistic multiculturalism.
But I mean, that's a variation on the fashionable thing. It's like, oh, well, you've got cooties, and now you've got cooties all over the Celtic cross. You know, you're making it unfashionable because you associate yourself with it.
And here's the comeback. I don't want to mention the name to dignify this person, but no, genius, it stands for Irish Irish Catholicism. I suppose y'all's got a bonfire for them too. So there it is. It's a bad argument. It's a misrepresentation, and we don't want to bonfire anybody. And I pointed out to this person, I don't know, I'm not sure if it's a girl or a boy, but it's actually the Kinnis principle that wants to sustain Irish Catholicism rather than blending it out. There, it's this person's position that wants to bonfire all the races out of existence. Ridiculous.
Right. Well, you know, one common factor of all these subversive movements, they can't tolerate the presence of the others even existing. It's yeah. sort of an Orwellian thing where you have to completely block out. You know, a Marxist can't just let capitalists go be elsewhere. It has to be global. Yeah. Because as long as there's this outer enemy, it's the same way, you know, and they project that when they're arguing with us. You know, I'm like, you know, and it's the same way with interracial marriage. And a lot of the listeners out there might not agree with me on this, but, you know, when acquaintances or whatever turn up to be in an interracial relationship, I don't get angry at them. I'm just like, oh, okay, you guys chose that way. Okay. And that's, they're going a different way. And, you know, God bless them. But as for me and mine, we're going to go the other way. Yeah, and, you know, they don't.
Mm-hmm. It's not like you can do anything about it.
Yeah, you can't do anything about it. And, you know, I'm not advocating for some world in which there are no other races or where there are no mixed race people. I just know for me and mine, I don't want that. And that's genuine diversity. Not to play word games, but you know they can only see it in terms of this sort of universal global thing. And when they argue, they're like, in the future, you know, we won't have any more racial strife because we'll all be a delicious mocha collar.
That's it.
You know, and it's like, wait. Just because you guys are doing that, are you guys going to force me to? And the answer is sort of a yes. You know, they haven't quite figured out how to force it just yet, other than, you know, forcing the children to mingle closely. And, of course, that does end up causing interracial relationships. And they if they push them together hard enough, long enough, with enough propaganda, they'll definitely have some kids. Have some young people interracially mingling, and you know, I think that's unfortunate because not just because of what we lost, you and I lost by losing members of our extended family. Those kids don't have a tribe, you know. Those and that doesn't seem to matter now because we're in this sort of superficial bubble before the fall, where we think we're post-tribal, where we think you know nobody needs. Nobody needs patriarchy. Nobody needs an identity because you have this government machine feeding everybody. It goes back to, you know, what would happen if you had a magic refrigerator that just constantly gave out food?
Yeah.
You know, you'd let the neighborhood kids come over. Why not? You know, why only give your groceries to your own kids if you've got an unlimited refrigerator? And, you know, we have a generation, well, all the generations existing, can't imagine the refrigerator being empty.
Right.
And until they see an empty refrigerator, they're not going to, Mr. Obvious Show, I don't know how many old school Bob and Tom fans we have out there, but, you know, the Mr. Obvious.
Oh, yeah. Those guys, I forgot.
There's your problem. You know, a lot of these things will only be obvious whenever they're looking, you know, at that empty refrigerator and realizing that some tough decisions have to be made. And the hard truth is that those people who don't have any identity to go to whatsoever are sort of children of the multiracial age are just going to fall between the cracks. And that's really unfortunate.
It's funny you mentioned Bob and Tom. Unfortunately, I used to be a fan of Bob and Tom. They've really, I hear they've gotten a lot more PC than they used to be. It used to be back in the old days, you could hear them making race jokes and fag jokes. And not anymore. They had one Mr. Obvious Show where a guy calls up, hey, my dishwasher's broken. It's making this weird noise. It turns out it wasn't, I'm sorry, was it a dishwasher or garbage disposal?
My dishwasher's not working.
And it turns out
on YouTube.
It wasn't a Mexican.
Listeners out there. Yeah, it ended up, you've got a dead Mexican in your kitchen.
In the kitchen. They couldn't get by with that today, though.
It's got a little green card. But the Mexican consulate. That's not a dishwasher. That's a dead Mexican. Yeah, but
yeah.
I haven't listened to them since like the 90s. Yeah.
I want to thank Steve Jackson for becoming the 900th Facebook follower. So that's
all right.
That's really cool.
What did he win? Is there a door prize with that?
There is. There is an autographed copy of Matthew Parrott's Hoosier Nation. How's that?
Well, you better come quick because I think I only have like 3 copies of that left. Okay.
Steve's from Winston-Salem, North Carolina. Thanks, Steve. And then Matthew Cart points out that we're on iTunes, the Tribal Theocrat podcast are on there, and all the audio, and you can leave reviews. So if you want to leave a good review or a bad one, go ahead. And what did I want to say?
Well, I can't see the chat room because it started making noise. I was afraid of that being a distraction, so I closed all my windows. But if anybody's asking questions or wants to ask questions, they should definitely.
Yeah, here's one actually from one Matt to another Matt. Question for Matt. How do you answer the Christians that say their identity is in Christ, not in a people group?
Well, I would say it's not either or, and that goes back to leaning on the family thing. Your identity is, and your first priority is Christ, obviously, and naturally and appropriately as a Christian. But part of one's Christian obligation to stewardship and service is to the family and to the tribe. And I think that's consistently biblical. And, you know, it's not either or.
Yeah,
when you serve your children, when you take care of your wife, or, you know, when you respect the wishes of your husband, or, you know, when you work on your marriage, you're serving Christ indirectly. And I think that's the same way whenever you're fighting for your nation, especially as we wish it to be an explicitly Christian nation, where, you know, it's safe to be a Christian.
This next one, I'll take this one. Does kinism require ecclesiastical exclusion of interracial couples? And I think that this is here where I'm going to turn into a libertarian and say that at least the minister should have the freedom to say, I cannot officiate that wedding. Or I know they're asking specifically about whether they can become members, but let's start before that. You typically have to get a minister to marry them. I think that a pastor should be able to say, no, I don't approve of that union, and say no. And so that would force them to a church that does allow that. And personally, and you can weigh in here, Matt Parrott, if you want, but I think that it starts a trend you don't want. And even some of the Southern agrarians in the South had certain laws ecclesiastically that separated the races. And the reason for that was they thought that this having this integration would promote a tendency eventually to miscegenate and to amalgamate the race. So it wasn't a way of saying, hey, we don't love you, we don't want to fellowship with you, we don't want to sing hymns with you. It was a way of protecting the race and saying this isn't wise. What are your thoughts on that, Matt?
Well, I parsed that very carefully, and ultimately I'm not even a racialist. I'm a tribalist whose tribe happens to be exclusively white. You know, I think in places like Brazil, where traditionally and historically and culturally you have a sort of transracial ethnic group, or in Mexico for that matter, that's up to them. I just know that my tribe has historically and traditionally always been European. That's our ancestry. That's our identity. That's who we are. And, you know, if other tribes wish to define that a different way, I have no authority or room, you know, and I'll be happy to be in spiritual communion with Christians the world over of every race and color and marriage. I might consider it unequally yoked, but that's really not within my jurisdiction to conclude that.
Great. Mickey Henry's on it again. He posted a link to an article by Robert Dabney called The Ecclesiastical Equality with Negroes. And to answer Eric's question a little bit further, and to piggyback on what you said, Matt, this is where the Fifth Commandment really comes into play. And I did a recent podcast called Is Kinism Scriptural? And one of the big arguments we have is that the Fifth Commandment gives the parents, the father particularly, the prerogative of saying whom his daughter can and cannot marry. And by extension, this should apply to pastors too. And there may be a better church for you down the road. So I would say, as a pastor, no, I don't want you here as part of this communion. But pastors should have that prerogative to set those standards of membership. That's my position. So kinism doesn't require ecclesiastical exclusion of interracial couples. But I think it does require the freedom for pastors to make that decision unequivocally.
Well, I think part of why this is so entangled, why this is so confusing, is that Christianity in America, especially over the last 50 years, but the Orthodox might argue for the last 1,000 years, the link between culture and one's church has been broken to where, you know, whether it goes to this church or that church, it is very much almost like a fashion choice, you know. Oh, well, I'm dating so-and-so, so I guess I'm no longer, you know, Presbyterian, I'm Episcopalian. And it's all Christian, la-di-da. And, you know, in traditional Christianity, whether it's, you know, and you see this some with, like, the Irish Catholics, and in a lot of, Scottish Presbyterians or whatever, but you see it very strongly in the Eastern Orthodox. You know, if you're a member of the Romanian Orthodox Church, and I attended one for several months before I moved, you know, it's so tightly integrated into your identity, your culture, and your faith, your religion, and your church, and your folk traditions and your festivals and stuff that the two are sort of innately and integrally inseparable, to where converting to the religion really requires a complete cultural conversion as well.
Good thoughts. Do see that article by Dabney?
I'll check that.
Well, I'm really speaking to the Eric and the other listeners, but you're welcome to as well. DabneyArchive.com has all of his PDFs on there. And Eric says the question came to my mind while listening to one of my podcasts on Swanson. He's curious if Swanson is permanently out of the Kinnis camp, since he can't undo his... Oh, I see. Yeah, Mr. Swanson married a half-Japanese woman, and the question is he out of our camp? And, well, he can become a Kinnis, even though he's married to a Japanese wife, and quit advocating what he did. That would be what I would advise for Mr. Swanson, is to... If you do want to be in the Kinnis camp, then you need to quit the multicultural message. I guess he's asking here, could he be a part of my Kinnis camp? I personally wouldn't want my white daughters and sons raised up in a church where their only selection would eventually be brown people. So that's my ultimate answer. No.
Right, and you know, you don't have to be hostile to them. You can link to them. I think, like, Fred Reed is married to a Mexican woman and lives in Mexico, and his articles and his ideas are absolutely wonderful. And I met the guy at the American Renaissance 2008 conference, and I really love him. He's got this perspective on America that's so sorely lacking. And yet at the end of the day, he's made that choice, and you know, he knows how I feel about it, and right. I know how he feels about it, and we're going to disagree on that. And it's not something, you know, that can be changed or whatever. I wouldn't ask him to leave his wife or whatever. He doesn't belong to my people anymore, but that doesn't mean there needs to be any ill will or disrespect.
We've got multiracial couples at our church, or one or two, and they have mulatto children. And, you know, we're friendly with them, and they're good folks. They're good Christian people. How close do we get to them? Well, we don't get too intimate with them. So that's a decision you have to make. It doesn't mean that you have to be a snob and say, well, I can't talk to you because you committed the sin of miscegenation. You can still be friendly and amicable, but it doesn't mean you have to be completely intimate and eventually pass off your daughters to their kids. Matt, did you want to say anything about this anti-communist loyalty oaths?
Oh, yeah. Well, there's just this Washington Post article complaining about a few states still have anti-communist loyalty oath laws on the books. They've already been stricken down at the constitutional level, so they're not valid laws that can't be enforced. Sort of like Indiana's constitutional law, which was never officially removed, which says that black people aren't allowed to move to Indiana. Yeah. they don't talk about that very often.
No, they don't. I do recall reading that myself, and I think you mentioned it in your Hoosier Nation book.
Yeah. But it's the same sort of relic of a bygone age you know, the Washington Post, there's this push now to have those laws officially removed from the books. I guess we've sort of reached the point where we're actually, like, pro-communist now. We can stop pretending to, the left can stop pretending to not be sympathetic with communists and can go ahead and you know, clean up the last vestiges of resistance to communism, however inert and pointless they remain.
I think there are some states that still have anti-sodomy laws in the books. They're not enforced, but
I think it, actually within the last few years, I think Texas maybe, I think at the local level, the gay lobby has really pushed getting every last one of
those.
They
got them all out, okay.
They did a search and replace on that. America's entire legal code.
Well, let's get into this last item here that we talked about at the beginning of the show, and that is a really good video between two articulate Christian Kenist girls, and they just got in front of a webcam and made a transparent plea for their position and even some criticism of what we're doing by not taking action. So I'll just play some of these clips, Matt, and we can interact with them, okay?
Awesome.
And I did talk to Kristen today via chat and encourage her to make this public because right now it's locked down on Facebook to her friends. But I think it's worth putting out there. And someone had pointed out, Scott Terry pointed out, this is the first that he has seen, first Kenist video, at least by Kenists. There are videos like by John Weaver and stuff. No, those aren't videos. Anyhow, I'll shut up and play the clips. Here's the one where she's laying out the basic position of Kenism is a homeland for whites.
And not to say that we are better than other races, but to promote, community within the races. And obviously we're against miscegenation, so that's where that comes from.
Yeah, and that each race has its own nation that it can live in. I mean, the whites have no area to live in. I mean, we're spread out throughout the world, but then all these races are coming in and taking over those areas. And there's no safe place for the whites anymore.
And not only that, but we've been persecuted a great deal lately from other whites, which is the most shameful part of it all.
Indeed. You won't hear your pastor talk like that, will you?
Nope.
Really enjoyed that. Here's the next one on the hypocrisy and double standard. We've heard this before, but it's always worth rehashing.
You know, you talk about politics with flying colors. You talk about the churches you go to and pride yourselves in your denominations and what you've learned in church the last Sunday and where you're at with your walk in Christ. You know, you say, oh, I'm making Swedish food for Thanksgiving because traditionally it's great because my family's all Swedish and we come together and it's a lot of love. And I don't, like, why it's the same thing. You don't dog on Mexicans for having Cinco de Mayo. You don't dog on Jewish communities because they want to have Jewish communities.
And it's all fine to make racist jokes around each other, but then as soon as we say them, you know, for who we are, as soon as we say them, we get persecuted for it, we get yelled at, and we get called racist.
Right.
that's one that really upsets me, is it's okay to say redneck and white trash and hillbilly and all these white slurs. But, man, you'll be fired from your job if you let the N-word slip on accident.
Well, like I've said before, I think a lot of that has to do with the innate white supremacism of the left and of the mainstream. And if you look at how quickly America went from being pretty much overtly white supremacist to being anti-white, it happened too fast to be sincere. What actually happened was an inversion where picking on non-whites is seen as picking on retards, is seen as bullying the inferior. And whenever you frame it like that, all of these double standards, all of this stuff that doesn't seem to make any sense, falls right into place. Well, of course, people with two legs can make fun of each other's legs.
Yeah.
They've got legs. You know, of course you can make fun of white people. They've got whiteness. And you know, in the heart of the overwhelming majority of white liberals is the just innate assumption that they are superior to and sort of these overlords and caretakers. You know, global liberalism is really just white supremacism with a smile. And that's where I think a lot of these double standards come from, is from the belief that, you can't make fun of, you have to treat inferior people one way and superior people another. And you know, you can't say that, just like you can't say, well, you know, you're smart and Bob's retarded. You don't talk about Bob being retarded. That's taboo.
Well said. I mentioned that I'm going to be doing a forthcoming podcast on the question, is Kinism supremacist? And here's Nicole and Kristen answering that same question.
Because we, as Kinists, we're not white supremacists. As somebody recently asked me if I was a white supremacist, the answer is no. We believe that every race should have its own nation. Every race should take care of itself. And that we are to provide for ourselves. And we shouldn't be coming to the aid of other races. Races shouldn't be coming to the aid of us. You know, we need to take care of ourselves. And God will take care of us.
I know that scripture says that a man who cannot provide for and take care of his own household is actually worse than an infidel. And I also believe that as a people, we should be taking care of ourselves.
That's it right there. That's Kinism in a nutshell. And they were that articulate in front of a video camera. And
completely off the cuff.
I thought it was really good.
Yeah. First time around, too. I didn't come off that sharp the first time I started doing public off-the-cuff stuff. I don't know if I am yet. But there's an interesting point there, and this kind of comes back to Christian charity, and I think Kenneths really need to have this in their pocket when they're debating. Is charity to foreigners is such a threat to the leadership, the innate traditional and often Christian leadership of those countries. Whenever, you know, can you imagine a worse scenario for your family than if some stranger came into your house and just started giving your wife and kids money and stuff and toys?
Mm-hmm.
And you tried to get your kids to do stuff, and this guy was like, oh, don't worry about all that. I'll just buy you kids a maid to clean your room.
Yeah.
And all that kind of stuff. You would have this insidious undermining of your authority and the respect of your family. And that's what a lot of this, a lot of these Christians who run around to Africa while their people in their own communities are suffering and need their help, And that's not nearly as glamorous helping your neighbor as it is to fly to a Caribbean isle and help a bunch of exotic people in an exotic place. That's a real, vacation. I'm not saying that they're not doing real work over there, but they don't realize how that undermines patriarchy and makes it. And you see in Africa where you have these locals, they're trying to fight like this AIDS epidemic where millions of Africans are dying. And part of fighting that AIDS epidemic is fighting homosexuality. And you have these Christians from the West, from places like San Francisco and the East Coast, these white people who really, only know of AIDS as an acronym, who, don't have their families and haven't been there while the children, AIDS children, are dying. That's why they're so virulently anti-homosexual. And we just go over there and we're like, you can't say all this mean stuff. And what we're doing is we're undermining the Africans' ability to solve their own problems. We're taking away African solutions to African problems and so on. And it's not really helping.
No, it's not. It's not helping at all. I can't really add to that. That was really good.
Thank you. It's just something we've, because they really think they're helping when they're doing this stuff. And I don't want to be too hard on them, because when they go over there, they really, I think they really have Christ in their hearts, and they think they're doing the right thing a lot of the times. And hopefully they can be reached and help to understand that. First, you've got to take care of your house before you take care of your neighbor's house, and by extension, the opposite corner of the world.
And as you mentioned, there are plenty of our own folks who are in need. There's a project called the Christian Appalachian Project. There are whites, our kinsmen, your kinsmen, in desperate need in Appalachian regions here in our own country. Reach out to them before you go on that Juarez, Mexico trip with your youth group.
Right. And, be their stewards. That they are your extended family.
Yep.
And, when I'm doing stuff like that, I can connect with them. I have, stories from my grandparents and my great-grandparents, from Appalachia. And you can build these bonds and relationships and motivate them in a way you can't do with somebody who doesn't even speak the same language.
Absolutely. This last clip, and then we'll wrap up the show, is a good one. And they talk about, they broach the subject of a solution, and I'll just play it and give my thoughts on it.
That would be a wonderful thing for all of us kinists to get together and just be able to live the way that we know we're supposed to be living. And as a friend said, we could have the church be like a patriarchal ruling. All the men of the family get together and they talk in the church, and then it trickles down to the women and the children. And we're all raised in a family setting. And that way we can all grow together and fulfill what God wants us to do.
And I make that one the last clip, because I've always thought about the church and its role in promoting love for our extended family. And if they could start preaching about it and mentioning it in Bible studies, because it is a men-led organization, it would trickle down to the families, and this would be a good way to get the conversation really flamed and really started. What are your thoughts on what she proposed?
Oh, I agree. I think it kind of dovetails back to what the point I failed to make with the national anarchism is about figuring out how to solve these problems and lead our people ourselves, replacing stuff we've come to rely on the government for with our own leadership and our churches and things like that, where the men and the women, I value patriarchy, but I don't want to make it sound like it's got to be at least half the women have to lead as well in their own way. And we have to kind of go back to square one and kind of relearn how to be a community, relearn how to govern ourselves. You know, we've sort of been infantilized and we've been domesticated. We're no longer a civilized people. We're domesticated people, and we got to figure out how to come together and solve our problems again from scratch.
Hey, man. Any closing thoughts you want to offer, Matt, before we wrap up?
No, I think I've rambled enough. I really enjoyed being on the show. I always enjoy this, and like you, I'm very heartened by Chris and Nicole's work there. I hope it's the beginning of more to come. We need as many voices as we can get making this valuable point. And with all due respect, I think they bring a certain magic to the message that neither one of us is capable of bringing.
I agree. Well, next week we're going to have, it's Saturday at 10 o'clock p.m. Hopefully, David Opperman will be on to talk about the scriptural and historical case for ethno-nationalism. So don't miss that one. And thanks for tuning in, and all the people in the chat room. We'll see you next Saturday.